Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
I'm Libby, and I'll be reading you today's Cape Cod Times, dated Friday, March 22, 2024. Today, temperatures will reach only into the low 40s, but it will be mostly sunny. Tonight, temps dip down almost to freezing, and the clouds and the rain move in. Saturday is supposed to be rainy all day. It will get up into the 50s, however. On Sunday, the temperatures will drop 10 degrees back into the low 40s. It will be cloudy, breezy, and much cooler. The sun is supposed to come back out on Monday. By special request from a few of our faithful listeners, we now present the lottery numbers. For the midday drawing in Thursday's numbers game, we have 7, 8, 4, and 4. The evening drawing that day were 2, 7, 1, and 9. Thursday's mass cash drawing numbers were 5, 20, 25, 27, and 32. The Wednesday Powerball drawing numbers were 13, 22, 27, 54, 66, and the extra ball of 9. And finally, for Tuesday's Mega Millions drawing, the numbers were 24, 46, 49, 62, 66, and the extra ball of number 7. The lead story on page 1 of today's newspaper is headlined, A Keystone Species. State Moves to Protect Spawning Horseshoe Crabs, by Heather McCarron of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline, Cumaquid. In the tidal flats bordering the beach at Mass Audubon's Long Pasture Wildlife Sanctuary, where the waters of Barnstable Harbor ebb and flow through the great marshes behind the Sandy Neck Barrier Beach system, a ritual that predates the dinosaurs will soon begin. Next month, Atlantic horseshoe crabs will begin to make their way to the shoreline here and all over the Cape to spawn. And this year, the event that peaks in May will take place without disturbances from harvesters, now that the Marine Fisheries Advisory Commission has adopted new regulations giving more protections to the crustaceans. On Tuesday, an estimated 100 environmental advocates, some carrying handmade posters calling for horseshoe crab conservation, joined representatives of Mass Audubon at the Wildlife Sanctuary to show support for the new rules. What started as a demonstration ended up as a celebration, said Mass Audubon President David O'Neill Tuesday afternoon, just hours after the State Commission approved more stringent rules around harvesting horseshoe crabs. What are the new rules protecting horseshoe crabs in Massachusetts? The commission, which works with the State Division of Marine Fisheries, voted 6-1 to adopt the regulations, changing course from a year ago when similar protections were rejected. As of Wednesday, the new rules were awaiting final approval by the Healy-Driscoll administration. The new regulations protect the horseshoe crabs during their spawning season. From April 15th to June 7th every year, they're no longer available for commercial harvesting, said O'Neill. This is significant, he noted, since that period is absolutely critical because they're spawning. They're adding to their population. Horseshoe crabs, which are not true crabs, but rather are more closely related to spiders and scorpions, are harvested for bait in the whelk and eel fisheries. They are also collected for the biomedical industry, which bleeds the crabs for a protein in their blood that's used to test medical equipment and vaccines for bacteria that can make people sick or be fatal to them. Although bled crabs are returned to the ocean, 15-30% die as a result, according to Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon Wellfleet and a member of the Cape-based Horseshoe Crab Conservation Association Board of Directors. Faraday said the populations on Cape Cod have been declining for years. He said he has long advocated for the state to put a stop to harvesting the crabs when they're spawning, the time when they are most vulnerable. The decline is borne out by surveys over more than 20 years. Faraday has been involved in the studies himself for about 17 years. The Cape Cod Bay population is the worst. It's been very low for years with no clear sign of recovery, Faherty said. The areas where we see a lot of crabs are places where bait harvest is either banned or very restricted. In Pleasant Bay, Monomoy, the populations are very high there. Some crabs may begin showing up to spawn in April, according to beach survey data from the Division of Marine Fisheries, but 90% of their spawning happens from about May 1st to June 7th. During the season, female horseshoe crabs come ashore and nudge themselves into the sand to lay nests of approximately 4,000 eggs. They may lay around 20,000 eggs in a single night, and 100,000 or more eggs over several nights, according to NOAA. The eggs are green and about the size of mustard seeds or peppercorns. As is the case with species that lay such an abundance of eggs, most don't survive. That's because the eggs and hatchlings are also a vital food source for marine animals and shorebirds, making horseshoe crabs important to a thriving and healthy coastal ecosystem, O'Neill said. The horseshoe crab is a keystone species that helps a lot of other species survive, he said. Notably, horseshoe crab eggs are an important source of nutrition for red knots and a related subspecies called Rufa red knots, which are migratory shorebirds that have historically stopped over on Cape Cod on their way between Arctic breeding grounds and nesting areas in the Gulf of Mexico and South America as far south as Tierra del Fuego. Red knots are listed as near threatened and Rufa red knots as threatened under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Scientists believe much of their decline is a result of depleted horseshoe crab populations up and down the East Coast. Ruddy turnstones, another migratory shorebird mostly seen in Monomoy and Chatham, also feed on the eggs, Faherty said. According to the Massachusetts Department of Fish and Game, the new regulations specifically prohibit all horseshoe crab harvest from April 15th to June 7th annually during peak spawning season. Establish a uniform bait fishery trip limit of 300 horseshoe crabs per calendar day for all limited entry horseshoe crab harvesters. The trip limit would then automatically increase to 400 crabs on August 1st. If 50% or more of the quota remains available, or automatically decrease to 200 crabs if 80% of the quota is taken before September 15th. Complement existing federal harvest prohibitions with state prohibitions within the boundaries of the Cape Cod National Seashore and the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. The agency indicated in a Wednesday email that the proposed changes will not reduce the current overall quotas of 140,000 horseshoe crabs for the bait harvest or 200,000 horseshoe crabs for biomedical purposes. Division of Marine Fisheries Director Dan McKiernan said the new rules bring Massachusetts protections in line with other New England states. The new rules also catch Massachusetts up with other East Coast states that previously increased protections for horseshoe crabs, including New Jersey, Delaware, and South Carolina, all also important stopovers for declining and threatened migratory birds like the red knots. It's been a long road, said Faherty. We're thankful to the Division of Marine Fisheries for bringing it back and getting it done. DeSantis, fleeing Haitians could end up on the vineyard, by Walker Armstrong of the Cape Cod Times. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made comments on a podcast Tuesday, suggesting he would send a potential influx of Haitian migrants to Martha's Vineyard, echoing the controversial move DeSantis employed in 2022 when he arranged to have 50 Venezuelan migrants flown to the island unannounced. The comments made on a podcast hosted by the conservative radio host Dana Loesch came ahead of a potential wave of Haitian migrants and asylum seekers fleeing the violence and chaos of their home country. In the event DeSantis were to arrange to have Haitian migrants sent to Martha's Vineyard, Chilmark Select Board Vice Chair James Malkin said the island would lend humanitarian aid and support, just as it did with the Venezuelan migrants. The island's towns, churches, and community would do the best it can to see that people were taken care of appropriately, legally, and with compassion, Malkin said. In recent months, Haiti has devolved into gang violence with civilians caught in the crossfire, and the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, announcing March 11th he will resign once a transitional presidential council is created. Florida has not yet experienced an influx of migrants fleeing Haiti, but DeSantis has signaled he is prepared to resume the program that flew migrants arriving at the Texas border to blue states in the Northeast and California. We do have our transport program also that's going to be operational, DeSantis said on the podcast. So if Haitians land in the Florida Keys, their next stop may very well be Martha's Vineyard. Malkin said when 50 Venezuelan migrants landed on Martha's Vineyard in September 2022, many of whom were children, the island came together to see that the humanitarian needs of all individuals were taken care of. There have been three times in my experience where the island has come together without any issues, he said, and this was one of them. The migrants were then voluntarily moved to Joint Base Cape Cod and Bourne, where many remained for a period of time before further arrangements could be made. Malkin said some returned to Martha's Vineyard for work and living arrangements. At the time, the move was called a blatant disregard for human life by a joint delegation of Venezuelan-American groups who also accused DeSantis of lying to Cuban and Venezuelan people when they said he pledged not to send migrants from either country out of state. A lawsuit was subsequently filed by the Venezuelan migrants and the Boston Legal Aid Group, Lawyers for Civil Rights, seeking a nationwide injunction to block DeSantis from engaging in actions which they alleged endanger human lives. The suit claims that the defendants made false promises about jobs, housing, educational opportunities, and other assistance if plaintiffs and class members were willing to board the airplanes. Lawyers for Civil Rights could not be reached Wednesday for comment. After Cape and Islands, District Attorney Robert Gallibaud II took office in January 2023, his administration looked into whether charges related to any potentially criminal activity might be filed because the migrants had been flown to Martha's Vineyard. All materials were reviewed that were made available to us, Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office spokeswoman Danielle Whitney said Thursday. Ultimately, the matter was referred to the U.S. Department of Justice, she said. Few options available for single homeless women. By Ruhan Yang of Boston University Statehouse Program. After years of being homeless, Amy adapted to living on the streets under insecurity. I thought I wasn't going to wake up, but I woke up and I'm fine. The more I feel adapted to staying outside without a person that stays with me, the more I wouldn't feel scared, she said. At the age of 19, Amy decided to flee from her family because of her father's emotional abuse. Since then, she started sleeping in the park or on the streets and going to churches for food. Being out on the street means living in fear and uncertainty. I literally slept on the grass, on the streets. I was afraid that someone would come up and hurt me, or animals would bite me while I was sleeping, or bugs would jump on me, she said. The environment scared me the most. Where am I sleeping? What should I do after I get up? It was morning. What should I do? I couldn't go back home. It's not a home. After facing repeated rejections from different homeless shelters due to having a family home, she shared her experience with Audra Doody, the co-executive director of Safe Exit Initiative, a nonprofit that has operated a women's shelter, Harbor, since 2021. Doody understood her, so Amy now comes to this shelter daily. Right to Shelter in Massachusetts. It was about 40 years ago that Massachusetts became the first and only state to implement the Right to Shelter law to provide shelters and other necessary services to homeless parents with children, pregnant women, and migrant families arriving in Massachusetts. But the reality is individuals are excluded from the Right to Shelter law. Single homeless women will have much more limited options toward finding a shelter, Senator Jamie Eldridge, a Democrat from Marlboro, said. Yet most areas of the state, outside of certain cities, There's really not much of a shelter system, and there's no shelters for women. Very few, he said. It doesn't really meet the needs for my region, not to mention many other parts of the state. According to a report from Massachusetts Coalition for the Homeless, the number of individuals experiencing homelessness has more than doubled since 1990, while the number of shelters, only for women, is less than 20 in Massachusetts. Last year, Duty made a difficult decision to close the overnight portion of the harbor shelter due to a lack of funding. But she added that they're trying to bring the overnight portion back. We're in conversations with a couple of people to figure out if there's funding to operate, maybe during the winter months, especially because there's such a need. I don't know about ever being open that full days again, and I do want to because we have a space, so I'd like to look at the options of the winter merge, she said. In February 2023, Senate and House lawmakers filed a bill on establishing a special commission to conduct an investigation and study regarding homelessness among women in the Commonwealth. Senator Robin Kennedy, a Democrat from Worcester, said she refiled the bill from a previous session because she wanted to make sure the state is providing services and protecting marginalized communities. The challenges for homeless people can be similar, but domestic violence can be a unique one for homeless women, Kennedy said. A lot of women are seeking shelter because of domestic violence. We know that our domestic violence shelters are consistently full capacity, she said. When there's not an available shelter, bandwidth in domestic violence programs, oftentimes, women are seeking shelter and the homelessness system in the emergency assistance system. That's one area that disproportionately impacts women. Esther Rogers, Director of Housing and Economic Justice at Jane Doe Incorporated, the Massachusetts Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence, wrote in an email that for victims of domestic violence, removing themselves from the physical location where violence happened can be essential to their safety. However, due to the limited number of beds and shelters, they can be at far greater risk of being abused again. She added that survivors often face a myriad of other barriers. From financial insecurity, threats of their children being taken away, coercive control of bodily autonomy, forced use of illicit drugs, mental health challenges, and location constraints that makes it even more difficult to find safe, affordable housing, she wrote in an email. Andrea Calslow, the communications director of On the Rise, a daytime shelter for women, transgender, and non-binary located in Cambridge, also said that women in a shelter often face a lot of overlapping challenges, including having been a victim of a crime, having a disability or health issues, a trauma history, or mental health concerns or substance use and misuse concerns. It's a struggle to work through and continue to engage with systems, she said. It's just, I think, the underlining thing that every single person who's living in shelter or displaced somewhere, it's poverty, and that's underlying to everyone, said Robin Frost, the executive director of Massachusetts Coalition for the Homeless. According to the data from the National Women's Law Center, 11.2% of women in Massachusetts live in poverty, while women in Massachusetts make 84 cents for every dollar paid to men. Meanwhile, Frost said in her 25 years of experience running the agency, housing prices have skyrocketed to numbers as high as she's never seen. Kennedy said that Worcester, like all other communities in Massachusetts, faces a housing crisis, which is an overlay to other barriers that women are facing that lead to homelessness. The customer hasn't kept up with the income and hasn't kept up with that increase in rent. You know, we have a housing crisis to also address it, Kennedy said. According to Zillow, the median rental price for all bedrooms in Massachusetts is $3,250, up $100 over the past year. It's $1,217 more than the national median. People do not have the income to support the rent. So it's really important to understand that homelessness is a microcosm of what's going on as far as mental health and domestic violence. But every single person right now is without housing, because they're living in poverty and they can't afford the rent, Frost said. That's the biggest hurdle right now. You know, even making $25 an hour may not be enough to maintain housing. Frost said it's common for homeless people to be housed for a short period and then episodically become homeless again. They might end up living with a friend or family member for a short amount of time and then fall back into homelessness. She said the reason for that is homeless people can wait for 2 to 10 years until they can find affordable housing. There are individuals who are homeless for not just a week, but multiple years as they wait for affordable housing to come to availability, she said. Eldridge said establishing a special commission is important, but not enough. It's just a commission, and I'd rather see direct action. But I do think there's a need for a commission because I think that there are different shelter needs for different women going through different challenges. Beyond the special commission, Eldridge added they also encourage local housing authorities in Massachusetts to build more affordable public housing to address the needs of homeless women. I'm trying to encourage more of these housing authorities to actually leverage money, leverage the property that they have, and build more low-income housing, Eldridge said. I think that could provide a real supply of housing for women that are seeking shelter because that's, again, truly low-income housing. New rules for watercraft on Bourne beaches floated by Paul Gately, special to the Cape Cod Times. Dateline Bourne. Unattended watercraft could soon be cleared from Bourne beaches, marinas, and other public shorelines much more quickly and easily thanks to a rule change. Abandoned craft have plagued public and private marinas for years, said Shore and Harbor Committee member B. Paul Busheff at a March 6th meeting. He said some owners are encountering all kinds of difficulties. Others, he added, are just moochers. The Shore and Harbor Committee unanimously approved an amendment to the waterways regulations, adding town marina facilities and beaches to the areas where abandoned moorings or craft are deliberately anchored, sunk, or otherwise placed in the water or along town-owned shores. Craft, such as skiffs, canoes, kayaks, and paddle boats, would be deemed unattended and constitute a hazard and be removed via the harbor master Chris Southwood's written permission. The waterways amendment would not, however, involve boats in a maritime emergency, affecting those aboard or in the immediate vicinity. Southwood said dealing with abandoned items has become an everyday experience. Over the past 5 years, Harbor Patrol has noted a marked increase with property owners, tenants, and guests placing small craft of all types along the high water line so as to provide easy access to the water, he said March 6th. This has prompted the use of all-terrain vehicles and quads on the beaches. Where can Bourne take your watercraft? Southwood says there are some shoreline locations at which the move to deal more directly with abandoned craft would not apply. Notably, Fisher Family Land at Cape Cod Bay, where property lines extend to the mean low water line. For the rest of the shoreline at Sagamore Beach, he said, the town owns from the mean low tide line up to the seaward side of private property. We've noted more small craft being stored above the high water line, but apparently not far enough up to be on private property, he said. The numbers increase each year as people seem to copy what their neighbor does. The amendment grants Southwood more authority to demand and order vessel removal, the failure of which could lead to the craft being taken by the town into its care, legal custody, and suitable storage. Size does not matter. You'll now require a permit. Updated water access rules call for permits. Without them, watercraft placed on any town-owned waterfront property and not removed will be prohibited and the vessel legally considered abandoned, the amendment notes. Any vessel declared to be abandoned will have to be removed or relocated within 24 hours of written notice to the owner and a town hall posting at Perry Avenue in Buzzards Bay. Short of corrective action, Southwood says the craft may be moved by the harbor master at the owner's expense. This extends to a growing request for moorings at the Sagamore Beach Basin north of the Cape Cod Canal's east end. We've begun to see new applicants requesting their mooring being placed in a location convenient to their property, even if it's not at the waterfront, Southwood said. The obvious issue is private property being left overnight and possibly for the season on town property. When the storms come, the items are kicked off the beach. What happens when a boat or other watercraft is deemed abandoned? Here's an example. An unauthorized dinghy at a town dinghy dock requires a permit. The town will try to identify an owner, Southwood said in a March 12th email. If the town is unable to contact the owner, a waterways notice is issued, giving the boat owner 48 hours to remove the vessel. If not removed, the town will remove it and store the vessel in a secure location, he said. Then, if the owner contacts the town, there will be a $50 fee associated with reclaiming the item. Otherwise, after the appropriate amount of time has passed, it will be placed in a town auction, the harbor master said. The abandonment revision, meanwhile, goes to town council Brian Bertram's review before returning to the advisory shore and harbor panel and ultimately select board scrutiny. Pearl Harbor survivor, one of few left, dies at 102. By Audrey McAvoy of the Associated Press. Dateline Honolulu. Richard C. Dick Higgins, one of the few remaining survivors of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, has died, a family member said Wednesday. He was 102. Higgins died at home in Bend, Oregon, on Tuesday of natural causes, granddaughter Angela Norton said. Higgins was a radio man assigned to a patrol squadron of seaplanes based at the Hawaii Naval Base when Japanese planes began dropping bombs on the morning of December 7, 1941. He recounted in a 2008 oral history interview how he was in his bunk inside a screened-in lanai, or porch, on the third floor of his barracks when the bombing began. I jumped out of my bunk and I ran over to the edge of the lanai, and just as I got there, a plane went right over the barracks, he said, according to the interview by the National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg, Texas. He estimated the plane was about 50 feet to his side and 100 feet above his barracks. He described big red meatballs on the plane, in reference to the red circular emblem painted on the wings and fuselages of the Japanese aircraft. So there was no doubt what was happening in my mind because of the things that had been going on, he said. Norton called her grandfather a humble and kind man who would frequently visit schools to share stories about Pearl Harbor, World War II, and the Great Depression. Norton said he wanted to teach people history so they wouldn't repeat it. It was never about him, Norton said. The heroes were those that didn't come home. Higgins was born on a farm near Mangum, Oklahoma, on July 24, 1921. He joined the Navy in 1939 and retired 20 years later. He then became an aeronautics engineer for Northrop Corporation, which later became Northrop Grumman, and other defense contractors. He worked on the B-2 stealth bomber, Norton said. His wife, Winnie Ruth, died in 2004 at the age of 82. They had been married for 60 years. Not long after he went into hospice last Thursday, he told his granddaughter, I'm ready to go see Winnie Ruth. I said, it's okay, go home. Be with Jesus and be with Winnie Ruth, Norton said. It's okay to do that. Leave us. You've had such a good and full life. There are now 22 survivors of the attack still living, said Kathleen Farley, the California state chair of the Sons and Daughters of Pearl Harbor Survivors. Farley said other survivors may still be living, but not all joined the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association when it was formed in 1958, and so may not be known to her. About 2,400 servicemen were killed in the bombing, which launched the U.S. into World War II. The USS Arizona battleship alone lost 1,177 sailors and Marines, nearly half the death toll. About 87,000 military personnel were on Oahu on December 7th, according to a rough estimate compiled by military historian J. Michael Wenger. Higgins is survived by two children, two grandchildren, and four great-grandchildren. We've reached the halfway point of our program, and regular listeners are aware that at this stage of the broadcast, we move to the obituaries. Our first obituary is for John R. Hughes. Dateline, West Yarmouth. John Jack Hughes of West Yarmouth passed away suddenly at his home on Friday, March 8th. Jack was born on December 8th, 1939 in Springfield, to the late John and Mary Hughes. He was raised in the Hungry Hill section of Springfield and was a graduate of Cathedral High School, class of 1957. After graduation, Jack served 4 years in the U.S. Navy, serving as a naval man on the USS Canisteo, and we thank him for his service. Burial services will be held in Bourne at the Veterans Cemetery on the morning of March 26th. The family is planning a mass and celebration of life in Western Massachusetts to follow in the future, where they will invite friends and family to come and celebrate Jack's life. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made to Shriners Hospital, an organization near and dear to Jack. For the full obituary, please visit the website of Chapman Funeral. Dorothy Ann Norrish, Dateline, Wilmington. Dorothy Ann Norrish passed away on March 17th after a period of declining health. Dottie was born on July 13th, 1946, to Stacia and Edmund Koziski in Greenfield, Massachusetts. She attended Greenfield Schools and Chandler School for Women in Boston. Dot lived in Greenfield for 42 years, where she raised her 2 children. Dottie loved Cape Cod and moved there with her husband of 33 years, William Norrish, Jr., in 1989. They lived in New Seabury, where she worked as a real estate agent for New Seabury Real Estate for 26 years, then moved to North Carolina in 2020. Her interests included baking, cooking, Boston Celtics, shopping, the ocean, and spending time with friends and family. She is survived by her husband, William, a son, a daughter, a stepson, and a stepdaughter. She also leaves 7 grandchildren and a great-grandson. She is also survived by her brother Richard and several nieces. John J. Rademacher, Dateline, Centerville. John J. Rademacher, age 89, of Centerville, died on March 19th. He was the beloved husband of the late Joyce Massey Rademacher, with whom he shared 56 years of marriage. Born in Salisbury, Maryland, he was raised and educated there. It was also there that he met his high school sweetheart, Joyce Massey. John graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School of Business, and soon after began his career in the business world. He was employed by the Melville Shoe Corporation and advanced to the position of Senior Vice President of Tom McCann Shoes. A former resident of the Worcester area, John and Joyce retired to Centerville and enjoyed spending their winters in Punta Gorda, Florida. He enjoyed boating, golf, and fishing, and was a member of the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary. He is survived by his 4 children, his grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. He was the brother of William, Lee, Margaret, and the late Nancy Collins, and is also survived by several nieces and nephews. Visiting hours will be held at the Doan Beelen Ames Funeral Home on West Main Street in Hyannis on Monday, March 25th from 4 to 6 p.m. A mass of Christian burial will be celebrated on Tuesday, March 26th at 11 a.m. at Our Lady of Victory Church on South Main Street in Centerville. Burial will follow in St. Francis Xavier Cemetery in Centerville. John's family asks that you consider a donation in his memory to the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Daniel Paul Russo, Dateline, Middletown. Daniel Paul Russo, Dan, of Middletown, Connecticut, passed away on February 19th. Dan was the loving husband of Judith Celia Hampel Russo, or Judy, who predeceased him in 2018. Dan and his wife Judy were devoted to each other for 30 years. Dan was born to the late Dr. Joseph N. Russo II and Rosemary Thayer Russo in Hartford, Connecticut, and grew up in the Bloomfield, Hartford, and West Hartford areas, while later residing in Middletown since 1989. The Russo family also spent summers on Cape Cod in Osterville. Dan is survived by his brother, Frank T. Russo. His brothers, Nicholas, passed away in 2006 and Joseph in 2017. While Dan and Judy had no children of their own, they were supporting, loving, and ever-present as uncle and aunt to his nieces and nephews over the years. Dan graduated from the following academic institutions: the Loomis School in 1969 in Windsor, Connecticut; Trinity College in 1973 in Hartford with a BA in history and later a graduate fellowship in history; Suffolk University School of Law with a JD in 1978 in Boston; Boston University School of Law; the LLM Taxation in 1987; the American College in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania with an MSM, Master of Science in Management, in 2003; and an MSFS, a Master of Science in Financial Services, in 2003. Early in his career, he worked as an attorney in Washington for the U.S. House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee on the committee, professional staff, working with taxation issues, legislation, and committee matters at the full committee and subcommittee levels, and with members from both sides of the aisle. Subsequently, he held corporate legal positions for over 20 years, in addition to 20 years in the financial services industry. For several years, he also consulted nonprofit organizations and was involved with political service to the city of Middletown for several decades, including as chairman of the Middletown Democratic Town Committee and chairman of the Middletown Planning and Zoning Committee. The family wishes to thank the doctors, nurses, and staff at Hartford Hospital and Pilgrim Manor Care Center at Covenant Village in Cromwell, Connecticut. They would also like to express their gratitude to family and friends for their support. Family and friends may call on March 27th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Doolittle Funeral Home on Old Church Street in Middletown. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made in Dan's memory to the Covenant Living of Cromwell Employee Appreciation Fund. To share memories or send condolences to the family, please visit the website of Doolittle Funeral Service. Judith Ann DeRoche, Dateline West Barnstable. Judith Ann Mahone DeRoche died on March 11th. Judy will be remembered as a loyal family member and friend, an active community member, a passionate advocate for the environment, an avid gardener, and a gifted teacher. She lived her life with grace and gratitude, and she was a loving, kind, humble, funny, hardworking, and generous soul. Judy left this life with hopes that more peaceful and healthy days are ahead for humanity and the planet. Judy grew up in Hanover, Pennsylvania, and attended Riviere College in Nashua, New Hampshire. She moved to Cape Cod with her family in 1969 and remained in the same West Barnstable home for 54 years. Shortly after the move, she began her long-standing activism on behalf of the environment. Judy was a member of multiple local groups, including the Conservation Commission and the West Barnstable Civic Association. She was voted the West Barnstable Citizen of the Year and received the Barnstable Land Trust Founders Award, two honors she highly valued. Judy enjoyed a 30-year career in the Bourne Public Schools as a teacher of children with moderate special needs. Following a sabbatical at Schumacher College in Devon, England, where she focused on teaching and environmentalism, she returned home to join the efforts to encourage the town of Barnstable to purchase the Conant property, now known as Meeting House Farm. As the farm's president for over 20 years, Judy, along with a group of devoted board members, volunteers, and donors, transformed the property into a beautiful space that offers the community and visitors the joys of gardening, walking, and connecting with nature. Judy is the former spouse and lifelong friend of Albert Joseph DeRoche, deceased in 2020. She is survived by her children, all of whom live locally on the Cape, and her beloved granddaughter. She is also survived by her sisters and her much-loved nephew and niece. A celebration of Judy's life will be scheduled in the coming months. In lieu of flowers, please consider donating to Meeting House Farm or an environmental organization of your choice. The Ask Carolyn column today is headlined, Mom Guilt Trips Law School Grad-to-Be Over Family Celebration. Dear Carolyn, I've never had a graduation party. I recognize they aren't necessary, but they were semi-customary within my community, and even within my family, as my parents threw my sister, 8 years older, multiple grad parties during my childhood. For a number of legitimate reasons, my family never planned anything to celebrate those milestones for me, beyond at least one parent being at the ceremony itself. I was always fine with that. I put in the hard work to get a degree toward the career I feel most passionately about, and that's the important thing. I'm approaching graduation from law school after 4 years of night school while working full-time, and I made an offhand comment to my mother that it would be nice to have a small graduation party with family. My mother's initial response was that no one would be willing to travel to be there, how stressful it would be to plan, and how much money it would cost, even though I'd already offered to pay and do most of the planning, and had emphasized that it wasn't about perfect attendance from family members as much as a nice opportunity to visit. I'd only asked her in the first place because she still lives near all her siblings, but she's made me feel so guilty for suggesting it that I almost wish I hadn't mentioned anything at all. I've since withdrawn the suggestion entirely, but she keeps saying my parents would be happy to do something to honor me. Her general demeanor has made me feel as if my accomplishment itself doesn't matter unless I can plan every last detail. Is there anything I can do to keep myself from reading the "You're not worth my time and effort" subtext in her words? Signed, "It's my party, I can plan it if I have to." Dear, "It's my party, I can plan it if I have to." I don't know why your parents threw parties for your sister, but never for you. I don't know whether the 8-year age gap affected their ability or willingness to do it. I don't know whether their reasons during your childhood are the same as your mother's excuses now, and whether the gaslighting is some new flair or a longtime signature move. I don't know whether this narrow grad party issue reflects a broader family trend. I do know that if you pretend she means Y when she said X your whole life, then you'll never buy it. So I won't advise any keep myself from tactics. Instead, look straight into the void. Your mom no-showed, and that hurts. You earned a round of applause and weren't wrong to ask for it. The mistakes you don't want to make now are to keep pinning your hopes on something she apparently can't give you, and doubting yourself because of it. Don't agree with mom that you're ex just because that's her subtext. Moms are people, meaning they're wrong about stuff all the time. Of course this hurts, so consider this a perfect occasion to launch a new approach to support and celebration, choosing your people for how they treat you versus how they're related to you, and not counting on mom for your plans. Congrats to B and good luck. I'm worried. Is the future of policing in Massachusetts in peril? By Allison Kuznitz of the Statehouse News Service. Public Safety and Security Secretary Terrence Reedy warned lawmakers this week that big cities and small towns face a major issue with recruiting new candidates for law enforcement jobs, and said he's worried about the future of public safety in Massachusetts. Speaking during a fiscal 2025 budget hearing Tuesday, Reedy shared with lawmakers the concerns he's heard from police chiefs throughout the Commonwealth and noted the widespread impact on police forces and the Department of Correction. The secretary attributed some of the challenges to negative public perception and a false narrative surrounding police officers and prosecutors. While Representative Todd Smola mentioned strategies such as offering signing bonuses to attract talent, Reedy lamented, "I don't know what the answer is. I know one small part we're trying to do is educate the public, in a sense, through our internship program, to give folks an opportunity to see what people do on the public safety side, including state police, including the DOC, including fire," Reedy said at a Worcester hearing. "Everyone loves the firemen, so they're not in the same boat. but it is a significant issue that I think is going to take the administration, the legislature, and our community partners. The secretary added, "I'm worried. I'm worried where we're going to be in 3 years, 5 years, if we don't have new blood coming into the system." Scott Hovsepian, president of the 5,000-member Massachusetts Coalition of Police, said Mass COP is supporting recruitment efforts and providing tools and benefits that help attract more people into policing. "We certainly share Secretary Reedy's concern about the lower volume of men and women entering or even exploring the law enforcement profession," Hovsepian told the news service. "Governor Healey has also expressed concern to us directly with this trend. We appreciate that the administration is prioritizing solutions. The state police is feeling the pinch from a dearth of graduates from its academy training program from 2006 through 2012, State Police Association of Massachusetts President Brian Williams said. Hiring efforts are also stymied by the 2008 loss of an education pay incentive, which previously gave state troopers a salary hike as they earned certain degrees, Williams told the news service. Some local police departments do provide that incentive, and some in the greater Boston area offer a base pay that can be 25% higher than that of the state police, said Williams and SPAM spokesman Chris Keehan. With those discrepancies, Williams said it would be an easy decision to join a municipal police department over the state police. "If we don't have the number to staff appropriately, then there's not going to be enough troopers on the road to respond to crashes or other critical incidents that occur every day," Williams said. "Members are being forced to work additional shifts, missing holidays, missing family events. It affects personal lives, and it affects the morale." Reedy did not provide concrete statistics about the public safety workforce woes, though he warned the attrition rate is high among civil service applicants. The number of civil service exam applicants for state police dropped from 14,314 in 2013 to 4,744, MasterList reported last March. "The other thing you should look at is the attrition rate among chiefs of police in Massachusetts," Reedy told lawmakers. "It's through the roof the last couple of years." More than 100 police chiefs stepped down in the months following the start of the police reform movement in the fall of 2020, said Mark Leahy, executive director of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association. Those departures have slowed, but Leahy told the news service the volume of candidates interested in open positions has dwindled. Leahy said the association has also seen a number of second-in-command officials not seeking the top chief job. The state police has about 2,300 sworn members, though the goal is to get that number above 3,000, Colonel John Maughan said at the hearing. "The force hovered near 2,000 at this point last year," he said. Maughan said retaining state police members is not an issue, but he noted the workforce is very mature. "I don't know the figure in front of me, but if everybody that could go decided to go, we'd be going backwards quite a bit," Maughan said. The state police has been under Maughan's leadership since February 2023. Governor Maura Healey topped Maughan to serve as interim superintendent and has not yet named a more permanent leader for the force. The Executive Office of Public Safety and Security told the news service in mid-January that interviews with the most qualified candidates were to begin soon. Are police vilified? Smola, a Warren Republican, had asked for Reedy's input on expanding the municipal police workforce, particularly in rural communities where small departments are more acutely feeling the strain of vacant positions. Smola said that being down one police officer could translate into 10 to 20% of a police department in central or western Massachusetts. He acknowledged that law enforcement in so many arenas seems to be vilified. "When police chiefs are offering big signing bonuses, big incentives to come on board, and they're still not getting the qualified individuals to apply for these positions, this is a huge problem," Smola said. Police chiefs are also struggling to make internal promotions as they lack workers who have enough years of experience to move up the chain of command, Smola said. That's another serious problem that we're hearing from a lot of different pockets of local police departments, Smola said. I'd just love to get your feedback in general on that, and how we, as a legislature, can kind of focus in with laser-like precision on trying to figure out how our municipal police departments are well prepared to be able to go after good qualified individuals, and to be able to keep them around for a while so that they can make sure that they have a full complement on their local departments. Reedy said he's been working with police chiefs and Maughan to tackle the narrative surrounding public safety professionals, as well as people's resistance to considering the available career opportunities. Ensuring a diverse pool of candidates for the state police, DOC, and the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security is another big obstacle in recruitment efforts, the secretary said. Our numbers were way down for that last RTT in the state police, Reedy said, of the recruit training troop. These are all warning signs, because when something goes wrong in the community, whether it's a small community or a city, you need first responders. Hovsepian, whose group has officers in 181 communities, tied law enforcement labor woes back to the heated debate that led to a law targeting policing practices, instituting a police certification process, and enacting other justice system reforms. It should come as no surprise to anyone on Beacon Hill, however, that so many talented men and women have been dissuaded from pursuing public service careers as officers, Hovsepian said. The hostile anti-police rhetoric which accompanied the debate over law enforcement reform in Massachusetts inflicted permanent damage. Here's Vote Pan d'Avignon, Best Brunch on Cape Cod, by Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. Guy Berenger would be proud. Berenger is the British writer who, in 1895, called for a new meal dubbed brunch to replace the heavy Sunday dinners that left people in a food fog. More than a century later, the breakfast and lunch combination is so popular that Pan d'Avignon Restaurant Boulangerie in Hyannis, voted Cape Cod's best place for brunch in our poll, doubled its brunch service 18 months ago. I've been bragging about it for years, Mario Mariani, Pan d'Avignon's chief operating officer, said of the Sunday brunch. I said to the chef, you're prepping all this food for one day. Why don't we add Saturday brunch? Brunch is served 10 to 3 Saturday and Sunday in the fine dining restaurant used for dinner. The decor is dark wood with carved room dividers and a warm red bar adding a splash of color. There is a large window looking into the bakery, where, for those who want to watch the baking, production gears up about 11 a.m. in the off-season and 9 a.m. in the summer when bread orders increase. We have so much wonderful bread, Mariani said, noting that the freshly made bread and pastry, along with other premium touches, make brunch appealing for people who want an elegant meal during the day. Those premium touches include all fresh mixers for cocktails. The Bloody Maria, made with tequila instead of vodka, is gaining popularity, and coffee brewed from beans roasted outside. In an aside, Mariani notes that Joseph Leon, hired as a busboy 13 years ago, spent time in his native Argentina learning roasting techniques before taking over the operation at Pan d'Avignon. In a spring project, Pan d'Avignon expects to open Pizza Lab, run by Neapolitan father and son pizza makers, Stefano and Tommaso Bobbio, at 15 Hinckley Road in Hyannis, where Pan d'Avignon Restaurant and Boulangerie is located, between Route 132 and the Cape Cod Gateway Airport. The brunch menu includes croque monsieur and croque madame, variations on a hot French grilled cheese, eggs, or l'œuf in French, chocolate croissant, fried chicken, fish and chips, homemade onion soup, and more. Pan d'Avignon won 46% of the 217 Cape Cod Times readers who voted, with the remaining ballots scattered among 14 other brunch places. Here are the five other top vote-getters. The Red Cottage Restaurant on Old Bass River Road in South Dennis. Red Cottage Restaurant, a cozy cottage painted a cheery red, has been owned and operated by the Rosenbach family for 41 years. Chef Dan Rosenbach graduated from Johnson & Wales University. Visit the restaurant's website for a more complete history of the 71-year-old establishment. Red Cottage is a cash-only restaurant, so hit the ATM on the way over. Be sure to try the Red Cottage home fries, described on the website as having fresh-cooked potatoes, onions, tomatoes, ham, green peppers, and mushrooms, combined with special spices and topped with lemon hollandaise sauce, a great upgrade from our regular home fries. The Good Friends Cafe on School Street in West Dennis. Stopping by Good Friends Cafe is like visiting a friend's house for breakfast or lunch. The cafe is known for its grilled breads and muffins, which sell quickly in this cash-only eatery. Chrissy Carr, owner since 2009, can often be found greeting people at the counter. What was once a seasonal spot is now open year-round, closed only for Christmas and in the off-season on Wednesdays. The Old Yarmouth Inn on Route 6A in Yarmouthport. If you have a hankering for southern food like white pepper gravy over sausage and eggs, make a reservation at the Old Yarmouth Inn. Charming with its own sense of history, the Old Yarmouth Inn only serves Sunday brunch from 10 to 1:30, so it does get busy. You'll find the white gravy on the Southern Fried Benedict, which also features biscuits. The Kitchen Cafe on Main Street in Brewster. The Kitchen Cafe is the newish kid on the block, coming to Brewster in 2021 after COVID-19 and remote working killed much of their business in Boston's financial district. They visited the Cape for the first time and found, as did their dog, that they enjoyed the vibe. Try the Morning Glory breakfast sandwich, stuffed with protein and promising to shore you up for a day of work following a night on the town. The Kitchen Cafe tied with C Street Cafe in Hyannis for fifth place, each earning 5% of the votes. And the C Street Cafe on C Street in Hyannis. It's a bright, sunny spot that is always busy. The menu lists a handful of specialty eggs Benedict dishes. The Cape Cod Benedict sounds good. Two poached eggs on mini lobster cakes topped with lemon dill sauce served with a French baguette. The cafe tied for fifth place with the Kitchen Cafe in Brewster. We'll close today with some poems from the Cape Cod Times monthly poetry contest. This is by Deanna J. Baxter, who lives in Yarmouthport. Unknown identified. The mountain, like a sentinel, guards the scattered birches while sunlight disciplines long shadows, tracking a scattering of graves, each with etched stones. They cling to the mountain like the roots of spruce that hover close by, an obstacle to those who might want to pry. The etched letters on stone converse telling tales of life on the earth. One stone sits apart and wears moss like a worn overcoat. Letters peep through buttonholes of moss, the captions made plain. Living 82 springs, she died when the heavy snows came. Traces of an identity, 1803 to 1885, a span of time unknown. She, like the split birch close by, overcame barriers, expanding the limits to survive. Each year, her heavy moss coat is soaked by the warm rain. Surviving the heavy snows, she now awaits the birth of a new spring. And that's all I have time for today. This is your reader, Libby, saying thank you for listening.